So if you take an ibuprofen for a migraine, right, you absolutely do not expect that pill to just, continue relieving your pain a month later.
Right. No, that would be completely absurd.
Yeah, like the chemical has been totally metabolized, it's flushed from your system. That would basically defy every fundamental law of traditional pharmacology that we have.
Exactly. I mean, the standard model we've all been taught is that a drug is basically a temporary mechanism.
Right, like a biological key.
Yeah, a key that turns a lock for, a few hours, maybe a day, until the body clears it out. And at that point, your baseline reality is supposed to just return.
But right now, and this is what we're getting into today, modern neuroscience is discovering that this foundational rule just does not apply to classic serotonergic psychedelics.
It really doesn't.
It's wild. Researchers are finding that a single dose of a psychedelic compound can fundamentally rewrite your baseline personality traits, alter the physical reactivity of your brain's fear centers,
Yeah.
and like reopen these critical windows of development weeks or even months after the substance has entirely left your bloodstream.
Which is just, it forces us to completely reevaluate the therapeutic window of these compounds entirely.
Totally. So, welcome to another deep dive. You, our listener, are the vital third mind in this conversation today as we tackle one of the most fascinating and historically overlooked phases of the human mind, which is the psychedelic afterglow.
Yes, the afterglow.
And the mission today is to completely unpack this phenomenon. We are pulling from a really comprehensive piece published in the OTW Journal titled The Neuroscience of the Afterglow, The Weeks After a Trip.
It's a fantastic paper.
It really is. It aggregates the subjective human reports, the clinical fMRI data, and some genuinely mind-bending animal models to basically explain why the most important part of a psychedelic experience is actually what happens when the trip is completely over.
Yeah, and I think we need to emphasize that the intense acute phase, right? The visual hallucinations, the ego dissolution, the peak experience that gets all the cultural attention.
The stuff you see in the movies.
Exactly. That stuff is merely the catalyst. The profound neurological restructuring doesn't just happen during those 6 hours of the trip. It happens in the quiet, highly malleable days and weeks that follow.
Which represents a massive shift in how we even think about this. Because for a long time, traditional clinical psychiatry just completely dismissed the afterglow, right?
Oh, absolutely. They dismissed it as mere folklore or just a placebo effect or, simply the psychological relief of having survived a highly taxing emotional event.
Like the relief of finally finishing a brutal final exam.
That's a perfect way to put it. You feel great, you feel lighter, but your brain hasn't like fundamentally mutated because you took a math test.
Right.
Yeah. So if a patient reported feeling profoundly different 3 weeks after a psychedelic session, the clinical assumption was that they were just riding a pleasant wave of memory. Because, again, if the drug is gone, the effect must be gone.
But any lingering psychological changes were just treated as, what, purely secondary reactions?
Yeah.
An afterthought.
Exactly. Just an afterthought. But the data we are going to explore today completely flips that assumption on its head. The afterglow is not a fringe anecdote at all. It is a distinct, measurable, neurobiologically real state of elevated plasticity.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we look at the cellular mechanisms and all the cool brain scans, I feel like we need to establish the baseline of what this actually feels like for the person experiencing it.
Yeah, the subjective experience is really where we have to start.
Because subjective feelings of, mental spaciousness are great, but for a long time, science ignored them because they are notoriously difficult to quantify. I mean, how do you
Yeah.
measure a feeling?
It's incredibly hard. And that's why the turning point highlighted in our source material was so important. It was a 2023 systematic review by Evans and colleagues.
And a systematic review is vital here, right? Because it bypasses the noise of just isolated anecdotes.
Exactly. You aren't just relying on one guy saying he feels great. They aggregated a massive amount of disparate data points from numerous controlled studies, and they focused exclusively on the subacute effects of classic serotonergic psychedelics.
And just to clarify for everyone, the subacute window, that's defined as the period spanning from a few hours to several weeks after the acute effects of the drug have entirely worn off,
That's
right?
correct. The drug is completely metabolized. And when you filter out all the noise and look at that specific post-acute window across different populations and different classic psychedelics, this very consistent phenomenological picture starts to emerge.
Yeah, and people aren't just saying they feel like good. They are describing a highly specific shift in how they process cognition.
Right. They are describing a profound sense of being lighter, calmer, and more open. The Evens Review cataloged these very consistent reports of heightened aesthetic appreciation.
Like music sounding better.
Yeah, music possessing a richer texture, colors appearing subtly more vibrant. But more importantly for, you know, psychiatric applications, there is this distinct reduction in the friction of daily social interactions.
Oh, wow. So the stuff that normally grinds you down just doesn't as much.
Precisely. Worries that felt catastrophic prior to the dosing session are reported to feel much quieter. They lose their stickiness.
Their stickiness. I love that word for it. The phrase that jumped out at me from the text was mental spaciousness. And I want to offer an analogy here to really visualize this for you, the listener, because understanding this subjective baseline is crucial for understanding the hard biology later.
I'm all for a good analogy.
Okay, so think about the cognitive load of a deeply cluttered, chaotic garage.
Oh, I have one of those.
Right? We all do. For years, you've been just stuffing boxes in there, ignoring the mess, the old sports equipment, the holiday decorations. Now, the psychedelic trip itself, the acute phase, that is the heavy lifting.
Right.
It's dragging all the heavy boxes out onto the driveway, sweeping the dirt, confronting the junk you haven't looked at in a decade. It is exhausting, sweaty work.
And it's important to note that the acute phase is rarely described as purely easy. It is an active, demanding psychological process.
Exactly. But the afterglow isn't the work. The afterglow is waking up the next morning, holding your cup of coffee, and walking out into that empty garage.
Right.
It's not just that the heavy lifting is over. It's that suddenly there is all this roomy space. You can breathe. You can actually, you know, park a car in there.
Which is what it's for.
Right. The old problems, the clutter, they just aren't taking up all your mental square footage anymore. It's this feeling of profound capacity.
That analogy effectively captures the transition from that acute effort to the subacute openness. The cognitive load has been temporarily lifted. And what the Evens Review proved was that this spaciousness wasn't just a handful of highly suggestible people having a good week. It is a definable, consistent phenomenon across the board.
But, you know, as a natural skeptic, my immediate reaction to subjective reports of spaciousness is to wonder if we were just looking at a massive extended placebo effect.
Which is a very fair scientific critique.
Right, because it's a beautiful feeling, sure.
Yeah.
But if this is a real biological shift, if the architecture of the garage has actually changed, we should be able to see it physically altering the brain's baseline in a scanner. Mm. Did researchers actually capture this happening?
They did. And honestly, it fundamentally altered the trajectory of psychedelic neuroscience.
Okay, let's get into this.
The source text anchors this physiological proof in a landmark 2020 study by Barrett, Doss, Cepeda, Picar, and Griffiths. This was conducted at Johns Hopkins.
The heavy hitters.
Absolutely. And they bypassed the subjective questionnaires entirely. They utilized fMRI functional magnetic resonance imaging to track blood flow and electrical activity in the brains of healthy volunteers well after a single high dose of psilocybin had left their systems.
And the methodology here is what makes this so incredibly compelling to me. They didn't just sit them down and ask, hey, how do you feel today? They tracked the physical reactivity of the brain over an extended timeline. So let's look at the 1 week mark first. What happened there?
So at 1 week post-dosing, the fMRI data revealed a physically blunted response in the amygdala when participants were shown photographs of fearful faces.
Okay, we need to pause here and establish the stakes of the amygdala for everyone because it's the primary engine of human anxiety.
It really is. It's the brain's threat detection center.
Right. If you were shown a photograph of a face expressing intense fear or anger, your amygdala should instantly light up. It's an evolutionary survival mechanism firing off a signal saying, hey, pay attention, there might be a predator or a threat in the immediate environment.
Exactly. That rapid blood oxygen level dependent signal, what we call the Boldy signal in the amygdala, is a biomarker for emotional reactivity. In a highly anxious individual, that fire alarm is overly sensitive.
It's going off when someone just looks at you funny at the grocery store.
Right. It triggers massive cascades of stress hormones at the slightest provocation. But 1 week after a single dose of psilocybin, when the Hopkins team showed these participants those exact same fearful faces, the fire alarm was physically muffled.
Muffled. Wow.
The physiological reactivity to potential threat was significantly dialed down. The brain just wasn't reacting with the same level of panic.
Which is incredible on its own. Just the fact that a week later, your brain is physically reacting differently. But the data that actually made me stop reading and just like reread the paragraph entirely was what happened at the 1 month mark.
Yeah, the 1 month data is where things get truly paradigm shifting.
Because at 1 month, The psilocybin has been out of their system for roughly 29 days. It's gone. Yet the Hopkins team found that not only did positive effect remain elevated, but their trait anxiety was significantly reduced.
And we really have to unpack the distinction between state anxiety and trait anxiety here, because it is the absolute crux of why this study is so revolutionary in psychiatry.
Right. State versus trait. Lay it out for us.
So state anxiety is transient. It is a temporary fluctuation in your mood because you are, say, stuck in traffic, or you are waiting for the results of a medical test.
Or you're about to go on a first date.
Exactly. It is a reaction to immediate environmental stressors. It's a state you are temporarily in.
And we expect state anxiety to fluctuate. That's just being alive, you know.
Yeah.
You get stressed, you calm down.
But trait anxiety is entirely different. Trait anxiety is a fundamental, deeply ingrained dimension of human personality. It is your baseline disposition toward perceiving the world as dangerous, threatening, or stressful.
So it's not how you feel right now. It's how you generally view reality.
Yes. In psychometric testing, traits are considered highly stable, almost permanent fixtures of your psychological architecture. It is a phenotypic marker that is often highly heritable and notoriously resistant to change.
Right. So if you identify as a highly anxious person, that is trait anxiety.
Exactly.
And you don't expect a core personality trait to just shift dramatically without, like, years of intensive cognitive behavioral therapy, or perhaps some major life-altering trauma or event. So when we see a durable downregulation of trait anxiety a full month after a single pharmacological event, I mean, that completely defies our standard psychiatric models, doesn't it?
It shatters them. It implies that the baseline architecture of how these individuals perceive reality was fundamentally recalibrated. The sensitivity of the sensor itself was adjusted.
That is wild.
This isn't just the drug suppressing a symptom while it's active in the bloodstream. This is the drug initiating a lasting structural reorganization of the brain.
And that forces a major mechanical question, doesn't it? Because if the brain's baseline fear response is physically altered a month later, there has to be a physical engine driving that sustained change.
There has to be.
A drug that metabolized weeks ago can't be doing the active work today. So what is physically happening at the cellular level to allow a core personality trait to just shift like that?
Okay, so the engine driving the afterglow, and this is where the biology gets really elegant, is a profound acceleration of neuroplasticity.
Neuroplasticity.
Right. Neuroplasticity is the physical substrate of all learning, memory, and behavioral adaptation. It is simply the brain's ability to reorganize itself by forming new neural connections.
And as we age, our brains naturally become less plastic.
Right.
The neural pathways become highly entrenched.
Very entrenched. There's a principle called Hebbian learning that dictates neurons that fire together wire together.
All right. So if you spend 20 years practicing a cycle of anxious rumination, what happens?
The physical connections between those specific neurons become thicker, faster, and incredibly efficient. It essentially becomes your default mode network's preferred path.
The path of least resistance.
Exactly. The brain is an energy-conserving organ. It doesn't want to work hard if it doesn't have to. So it prefers to use the thickest, most established highways. What the source material reveals is that classic psychedelics act as a massive, rapid catalyst for structural and functional neuroplasticity.
So they disrupt those highways.
Yes, they disrupt those established highways and promote the rapid growth of new dendritic spines and synaptic connections in the cortex.
I was reading about the specific molecular cascade that causes this, and it is fascinating because it's not magic. You know, it's a very specific sequence of events.
It's pure biochemistry.
Right. So the psychedelic molecule, let's say psilocin from magic mushrooms, it binds to the 5-HT2A serotonin receptors in the cortex.
That's the primary receptor, yes.
But that binding is just the spark. It's not the whole fire. That spark triggers a massive downstream release of glutamate, which is an excitatory neurotransmitter.
And that glutamate surge is critical, because it initiates an intracellular signaling cascade that leads to the transcription and release of BDNF.
BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor.
Exactly.
Which is essentially high-grade biological fertilizer for the brain. It is the gasoline that keeps the fire burning long after the initial psychedelic spark has faded away.
That's a great way to describe it. That BDNF release stimulates the rapid blooming of dendritic spines.
Let's visualize that for a second. If you visualize a neuron as a tree, The main trunk is the cell body, right?
Yeah.
And the branches reaching out are the dendrites.
Right. And the dendritic spines are the thousands of tiny little buds, like leaves just starting to sprout along those branches. They are the exact microscopic locations where one neuron receives chemical signals from another. They are the communication hubs.
So under the influence of this massive BDNF release, your brain is sprouting millions of new potential connection points. It is like a sudden, prolific springtime in the cortex.
A literal springtime, yes. And here's the key. This structural growth takes time. The new branches and buds take days and weeks to form, to stabilize, and fully connect into functional circuits.
Ah, so that's why the afterglow persists.
Precisely. The subjective feeling we discussed earlier, that mental spaciousness, that profound openness, is actually the felt sense of a temporarily more malleable brain. You are consciously experiencing your own neurobiology, being physically open to revision.
I love that. Experiencing your own neurobiology. I actually want to translate this heightened plasticity state into a concrete visual for you, the listener, because this is so central to everything. Think of your brain's default thought patterns like deep sled tracks on a snow-covered hill.
Okay, I like where this is going.
So you've been riding your sled down this exact same hill your entire life. Over time, those tracks have become deep, icy grooves. No matter how hard you try to steer, the sled just naturally locks into those old grooves and pulls you down the exact same path.
Which represents your trait anxiety.
Exactly. That is your trait anxiety. That is your fixed behavioral loop, your addiction, your depressive cycle.
The rigid neural architecture.
Right. Now, what this burst of BDNF and dendritic spine growth does is act like a massive fresh snowfall.
It covers the hill.
It completely fills in those deep icy grooves. Suddenly you are sitting at the top of the hill and it is a pristine flat sheet of white powder. You can chart a completely new path. The old tracks are buried. You just do not have to fall into the same rut you've been falling into for 20 years.
This fresh snowfall analogy aligns perfectly with another really durable psychological shift highlighted in the research, which is the statistically significant rise in the personality trait known as openness.
Oh, right, from the Big Five personality model.
Yes. In the Big Five model, openness to experience involves aesthetic sensitivity, imagination, and a high tolerance for novelty. And much like trait anxiety, openness is usually highly fixed. In fact, it actually tends to decrease slightly as we age and become more set in our ways.
We get rigid.
We get very rigid. But the clinical data shows a durable, long-term increase in openness following these psychedelic sessions. It is literally the psychological manifestation of a plastic, receptive, newly snowed upon brain.
Wow. But, you know, the critical question for neuroscience, and really for any therapeutic application here, is the timeline.
Great. How long does it last?
Exactly.
Yeah.
How long does that fresh snow actually last before it freezes over and the new tracks become rigid again? Because it can't stay fresh powder forever.
No, it can't. And to answer that timeline question, the source material points us toward one of the most elegant and frankly revealing studies in recent neurobiology.
Okay, so we are moving from human fMRI machines into animal models here. In 2023, the journal Nature published a study by Nardu and colleagues that investigated the concept of critical periods.
Yes. And for those who might not be familiar with developmental neurobiology, we usually associate critical periods with early childhood, not adulthood.
Right, like babies and toddlers.
Exactly. A critical period is a specific time-limited developmental window during which the nervous system is exquisitely sensitive to environmental inputs. It is the period when the brain is most fluid and capable of absorbing foundational skills.
What's a good example of that for the listener?
The most universally understood example is language acquisition.
Oh, sure.
A toddler's brain is in a wide-open critical period for language. They absorb grammar, syntax, and vocabulary from their environment almost effortlessly without direct instruction.
They just soak it up like a sponge. But if you try to learn a new language at age 45, I mean, I tried to learn Spanish last year, and it is a massive, exhausting cognitive struggle.
It is incredibly hard.
You have to use apps, flashcards, rote memorization, and you will almost certainly still retain your original accent.
Yeah.
The hardware has fundamentally changed, but why does the brain lock that window shut in the first place?
It shuts for evolutionary and energetic efficiency. The brain simply cannot remain infinitely plastic forever. If it did, you would constantly overwrite essential survival behaviors every time you encountered a new environment.
Oh, that makes sense. You'd forget how to walk just to learn how to swim.
Exactly. At a certain point in development, the brain has to consolidate what it has learned and prioritize stability over flexibility. So it literally builds a physical scaffolding around the neurons. These are called paraneuronal nets, which lock the synapses in place. The critical period closes.
The concrete sets.
But what the NARDU study in 2023 discovered is that classic psychedelics possess the profound ability to literally dissolve those paraneuronal nets and reopen these critical periods in full-grown adults.
Which is just, it sounds like science fiction.
It really does. Specifically, they utilized adult mice and focused on the critical period for social reward learning. Normally, adult mice entirely lose the highly malleable social learning capacity they possess as juveniles. The window is closed and locked. But when administered a psychedelic, that critical period cracked wide open again. The adult mice were suddenly able to form new, robust social reward associations with the exact same plasticity they had in their youth.
That alone is scientifically staggering. Just finding a chemical key to unlock a developmental door that your brain biologically sealed shut decades ago.
It's revolutionary.
But the data point from the OTW source that absolutely floored me was how they mapped the timelines of these windows. Because they didn't just test one drug, right? They tested an entire spectrum of compounds.
And they found a direct proportional correlation. The length of time the critical period remained open in the adult mice tracked perfectly with the duration of the acute subjective effects of those specific drugs in humans.
Okay, wait, break that timeline down because this is where the biology perfectly explains the clinical afterglow we were just talking about.
Let's go through it. Ketamine, which has a very short acute duration in humans, typically around an hour or two, reopened the critical period in the mice for roughly 48 hours.
Okay, 2 days for ketamine.
Right. Psilocybin, which induces a longer acute state of 4 to 6 hours in humans, kept the window open in the mice for about 2 weeks.
2 weeks of fresh snow.
Yes. LSD, which lasts up to 12 hours acutely, kept the critical period open for 3 weeks. And ibogaine, a very powerful psychedelic whose acute effects can last 24 hours or more, reopened the developmental window for up to 4 full weeks.
Okay, I have to jump in here and aggressively push back.
Go for it.
Because any rigorous listener is going to spot the gap here.
Right.
We are talking about social reward learning in adult mice. A literal mouse learning to associate a specific type of bedding in a plastic cage with the presence of other mice.
Yes, that is the exact experimental setup.
Isn't it a massive inferential leap to map a mouse's basic social conditioning directly onto the profound existential reframing of human trauma? Like, can we really draw a straight line from a mouse in a plastic box to a human being overcoming a decade of treatment-resistant depression?
That is a highly valid critique. And honestly, it is a limitation that any responsible neuroscientist will immediately acknowledge. A mouse is not a human.
Right.
The psychological content of human trauma, the narrative meaning-making, the existential dread, the complex social dynamics, none of that can be replicated in a rodent model. The subjective experience is totally incomparable. So how do we justify caring about this study?
Because while we cannot equate the psychological content, we absolutely can equate the cellular machinery.
Meaning the biological hardware that allows a mouse to learn is the exact same hardware that allows a human to heal.
Precisely. The extracellular matrix, the perineuronal nets, the 5-HT2A receptors, the transcription of BDNF, this physical infrastructure of neuroplasticity is highly conserved across all mammals through evolution.
So a lock is a lock, whether it's in a mouse or a person.
Exactly. The basic biological locks and keys are identical. So while the NARDU study doesn't explain the psychological revelations of a human afterglow, the proportional biological timelines, 48 hours, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, provide a staggering mechanistic explanation for the exact duration of the human afterglow reported in clinical settings.
It gives us the biological blueprint.
Yes. It gives us a biological candidate for what the afterglow actually is. A temporarily reopened window of developmental plasticity. The longer the chemical key is in the lock during the acute phase, the longer the door stays physically propped open afterward.
Okay, let's accept this biological reality. Let's say you've taken the medicine, the acute phase is completely over, the fresh snow has fallen, the paraneuronal nets have dissolved, and your brain is beautifully, perfectly malleable for a 2 to 4 week window.
Okay, you're in the window.
How do you actually use it? What happens if you have this profound, universe-shattering realization on a Saturday, and then for the next 3 weeks, you just sit on your couch, scroll through social media, and eat junk food.
If you do that, you are squandering the most potent therapeutic window of the entire intervention.
Seriously.
And this highlights a massive, massive divergence between recreational use and clinical application. In modern clinical science, the afterglow is not treated as just a pleasant vacation from reality. It is treated as the actual locus of therapy.
The actual locus.
Yes. The clinical term for this vital phase is integration.
Now, integration is a buzzword that gets thrown around constantly in the wellness and pop psychology space. But in this context, it has a rigid neurological imperative, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. If the days and weeks after the dosing session are a period of heightened structural openness, then that subacute window is when insight is actually consolidated into lasting behavioral change.
The peak experience merely disrupts the old patterns.
Right. It shows you what is possible. It lifts you out of the rut so you can see the whole hill. But integration is the deliberate, intentional work of establishing the new neural pathways while the concrete is still wet.
I want to reconceptualize this for you, the listener, because understanding the neurological weight of integration is the difference between having a fleetingly cool weekend and achieving true, lasting psychological transformation.
It's the whole ballgame.
Think of the psychedelic acute phase, like buying a massive truckload of brand new, top-of-the-line lumber and having it dumped right in your driveway.
Okay, I see where you're going.
You are thrilled. You have all the materials necessary to build a beautiful, sturdy new house. The lumber is the neuroplasticity, the BDNF, the open critical period.
But the lumber alone is not a house.
Exactly. The lumber alone is just a pile of wood. The afterglow is the 2 to 4 week window you have to actually pick up a hammer and build the house before the lumber just magically evaporates into thin air.
Right, because the window closes.
If you just sit on your porch and stare at the lumber for 3 weeks, feeling incredibly enlightened that you own it, eventually the developmental window closes. The paraneuronal nets lock back into place. The lumber vanishes, and you are left living in the exact same old, grafty, anxious house you started with.
That is a phenomenal analogy.
You have to build the new habits, waste the window, and you've wasted the material.
And this is exactly why rigorous clinical protocols do not end when the drug wears off. They intentionally schedule extensive psychotherapy integration sessions during the specific subacute window.
So you're in therapy while the snow is fresh?
Exactly. They utilize frameworks like cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, or acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT, to take the abstract, profound insights of the peak experience and anchor them into the friction of daily reality.
Right. Because insight without action is just trivia.
Yes. If a patient realized during their session that they use alcohol to numb social anxiety, the integration window is the critical time to actively practice new coping mechanisms, while the neural pathways for behavioral change are highly receptive.
If you are listening to this and reflecting on your own pursuit of well-being, I think this data forces a really important mirror onto our culture, because we are obsessed with the magic bullet.
Oh, completely.
We want a single ayahuasca retreat, a single profound book, a single exogenous substance to just go into our brains and fix the trauma so we don't have to do the heavy lifting ourselves.
It's human nature to want the quick fix.
But the neuroscience of the afterglow tells you the exact opposite. The work is never done for you. The medicine merely provides the optimal biological conditions to do the work yourself.
It clears the brush.
It lays down the fresh snow. But you still have to walk the new path until it becomes a road.
And that leads to a necessary and perhaps very sobering reality check regarding the nature of this biological state.
Right. Because what if you walk down the wrong path?
Exactly. What if you use that beautiful, fresh lumber to build a house that is actually more structurally unsound than the first one? This brings us to the crucial, honest limits of the afterglow and a phenomenon known in the literature as the shadow.
And the source text from the OTW Journal is very explicit about this. They emphasize that we cannot romanticize this plasticity. The afterglow is not a guaranteed state of glowing, unbothered bliss. Sometimes people experience a deeply negative subacute phase.
The shadow afterglow is a highly documented reality. After a particularly harrowing, difficult, or emotionally destabilizing acute session, what clinicians often refer to as a challenging experience, a patient might not emerge feeling lighter or calmer.
They might feel worse.
They might emerge feeling entirely drained, incredibly fragile, emotionally raw, or highly destabilized.
Wow.
That mental spaciousness we praised earlier can, without the right support, feel like a terrifying, echoing void.
Oh, man. It's like you cleaned out the garage, but instead of feeling roomy, you suddenly realized that the clutter was actually structural, load-bearing clutter.
Yes.
It was protecting you. And now you were just standing in an empty room feeling incredibly exposed.
This introduces a vital neurobiological concept that is so often lost in the mainstream enthusiasm for psychedelics. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the fundamental truth about neuroplasticity is that it is entirely, ruthlessly neutral.
Neutral. We really need to drill down on that because the wellness industry uses the word plasticity as a synonym for healing.
It is not a synonym for healing. Plasticity simply means malleability. Mm. It means the brain is highly susceptible to environmental inputs and repeated behaviors. Mm. A more malleable brain does not automatically default to forming healthy, well-adjusted habits. It is just as capable of consolidating unhelpful, traumatic, or anxious patterns if the surrounding environment is poor. The biological mechanism doesn't care about your well-being. It only cares about adapting to the inputs it receives.
So if the fresh snow has fallen and your old icy sled tracks are gone, you could just as easily carve a brand new track that leads straight into a brick wall.
Precisely. If you are in a state of reopened critical period plasticity, your perineuronal nets are dissolved, your BDNF levels are high, and you return to a highly toxic relationship, an abusive work environment, or just an unsupported, chaotic daily life, your brain is exquisitely primed to wire those environmental stressors into your neural architecture even more deeply than before.
That is terrifying.
The vulnerability of the open window works in both directions. You could inadvertently cement a trauma response.
This absolutely reframes why setting, and support are relentlessly emphasized by everyone in this clinical field. It's not just about playing soothing ambient music and having a nice lighting setup during the trip so you don't get scared.
No, it's so much bigger than that.
It is about aggressively protecting the integration window.
Set and setting during the subacute phase are arguably more critical for long-term outcomes than during the acute phase. It is about curating a safe, calm, and highly intentional environment while the neural cement is wet. If the brain is radically open to revision, you must ensure it is revising toward health, stability, and safety.
And this is exactly why the source text carries such stringent medical disclaimers. The OOTW Journal explicitly notes that these interventions are not biologically safe for everyone.
That's a crucial point.
Individuals with a personal or family history of psychosis, schizophrenia, or bipolar disorder are universally screened out of these clinical trials.
And for very good reason. Because if you introduce a massive burst of neutral plasticity into a neural system that already struggles with reality testing or manic regulation, you aren't just opening a developmental window. You run the risk of blowing the entire roof off the house.
It's just too destabilizing.
It is a non-negotiable safety parameter. To synthesize the evidence we've covered in this deep dive, we must remember that the incredibly clean, compelling data, like the Hopkins fMRI study showing reduced trait anxiety a full month later, comes from highly sanitized, specific conditions.
Right, they aren't just handing these out at a music festival.
No. These are small studies using rigorously screened, highly supported volunteer groups. The subjects were prepared extensively for weeks beforehand. They were guided during the acute session by two trained professionals, and they were supported therapeutically throughout the entire afterglow window.
So the beautiful lasting data is a product of that entire clinical container, not just the isolated molecule.
The container is everything.
The molecule is the spark, but the container is the fireplace. Without the fireplace, the spark just burns the house down. So the afterglow is a profound opportunity, but it is not a biological guarantee. The plasticity opens the window, but the environment, the support system, and the intentional psychological work dictate what actually flies in.
We are looking at a time-limited period of elevated mood, heightened BDNF expression, and unlocked critical periods. How that specific window is utilized determines the entire trajectory of the intervention.
Okay, let's pull all of this together. We've gone on quite a complex neurological journey today, starting from a place of deep medical skepticism. We saw how the traditional pharmacological model historically dismissed the days and weeks after a psychedelic experience as just a pleasant come down.
Right, ignoring it because it didn't fit the old active drug, active effect paradigm.
And we traced a scientific shift that proved that old model completely wrong. Through systematic reviews of the subacute window, we established the consistent, measurable shape of the afterglow. The mental spaciousness, the reduced social friction, the openness.
Then we looked directly into the scanner. we saw the physical proof that a single event can durably blunt the amygdala's fear response and sustainably lower stable trait anxiety weeks later.
We unpacked the cellular engine behind this too. The 5-HT2A activation, the glutamate, the BDNF cascades, the rapid growth of new dendritic spines laying down fresh snow over those entrenched neural pathways.
Which was further corroborated by those elegant animal models, demonstrating the literal dissolving of paraneuronal nets, reopening developmental critical periods for learning that scale directly with the biological half-life of the drug in the human body.
And finally, we grounded all of that theoretical biology in the practical, rigorous reality of integration, the absolute necessity of picking up the hammer and building the house while the window is open, while holding a deep, healthy respect for the fact that plasticity is neutral.
And that the shadow side of a vulnerable brain is a very real risk.
Now, this raises an important question, one that steps just slightly beyond the clinical data we've reviewed, but is entirely provoked by understanding these mechanisms.
I know where you're going with this.
If classic psychedelics act as a pharmacological key to reopen these critical periods of plasticity, it makes you wonder about the natural endogenous architecture of the human brain. Because the brain did not evolve these complex BDNF pathways and critical period mechanisms solely to wait for a specific fungus or synthetic compound to unlock them.
Right. The hardware was already built in long before we started synthesizing these things in labs. The capacity for rapid reorganization is natively human.
Exactly. So are there everyday non-pharmacological experiences, moments of profound, breathtaking awe, periods of intense, shattering grief, or sudden, deep, empathetic connections with another human being that are also triggering these cascades?
It's a profound thought.
Are these extreme human experiences also acting as natural keys, briefly dissolving our rigid nets and reopening these windows of plasticity?
That is a staggering thought to leave on. The idea that a moment of pure, overwhelming awe at the top of a mountain or the birth of a child might literally be melting the icy sled tracks in your brain, initiating a natural afterglow.
And if that is true, the vital question for modern life becomes, how are we treating those natural windows of plasticity?
Are we protecting them?
Right. When life hands us a moment of profound awe or deep grief that briefly opens our neural architecture, are we protecting that space? Are we taking the necessary time to integrate the experience? Or are we instantly checking our phones, distracting ourselves, and rushing back to our emails before the new cement even has time to set?
Are we wasting the lumber that life gives us for free?
That is something I am going to be thinking about for a long time. You know, we started this deep dive talking about how easy it is to obsess over the peak. But today, the neuroscience has shown us that the real work, the lasting structural transformation of who we are, happens in the quiet days afterward. When the mind is roomy, the nets are dissolved, and the fresh snow is waiting for you to carve a brand new path.
It's all about the afterglow.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the OTW Journal's research. Keep asking questions, keep protecting your windows of plasticity, and always respect the profound power of a changing mind.